So, good evening, everyone. We have the Dharma talk in progress with Muji the cat. Good evening. Wonderful to see everyone. I feel like I saw some of you not so long ago on Saturday because of the study group, and then I don't know. It seems like we've been meeting regularly, which is wonderful. I'm also involved in this course that I teach, and it was online for 2 hours before this, so it's a lot of screen time. It was nice to be able to just sit, even if it was facing the screen. And moving among so many different activities and different groups and different people on the screen. Excuse me, I have to let the cat out. Sorry. Letting the cat out, letting the cat in, all of these different activities. Life. And different locations on the meeting. In the meeting I was in before, you know, there were people in the west coast of the United States, different parts of the UK, east coast of the United States. I was the only one on continental Europe, but now a different constellation here. Everything is different, and everyone is different. We all come with our stories, our ideas, our opinions, our places, our identities. Whether we identify by social class, gender, sexual choice, economic status, occupation, race, so many different possibilities, so many differences. And yet, you know, so in Dogen's, it's actually not from Dogen, it's from another teacher, but we always say it's from Dogen, where he says, the mountains are mountains and the rivers are rivers. And so that's what I'm talking about. All of these differences, very specific kind of places and people and things and shapes and colors and forms and all of that. It's all different, right? So in Dogen's terminology, in the beginning, it's all different. And then later on, as we have some realization, everything is one. As Suzuki says, when we forget all of our dualistic ideas, everything becomes our teacher. And everything can be the object of worship. He says worship. Everything can be the object of wonder, of appreciation, maybe something like that. When we forget our dualistic ideas. And so when we get to this, when we have this realization that everything is one, we know things intimately then. Or as you know, another thing from Dogen is, you know, something like when we hear sounds with the whole body and mind, or when we see forms with the whole body and mind, we can understand them intimately or know them intimately. And in order to hear it or see it with entire body and mind, we have to forget about our ideas about it, whatever it is. And we can kind of see this in our daily lives. I mean, I'm just talking about my day today, where I have all these different things that I had to be handling. I'm preparing this big, long retreat next week with a lot of work, writing and meditation workshop, and it's a lot of work. I'm preparing that. I'm teaching this course. I had to think about tonight, sorting out administrative stuff. Lots of people in my household. And if I give myself entirely to each of these things, when it's the time to do it, then it's no problem. But when I try to do all of them, like not entirely, it becomes a mess. I don't really do any of them well. I don't really give my attention to any of them. I'm doing it partway, I'm doing it approximately, I'm not really listening, or I'm listening but thinking about something else. I'm, you know, if I was in my previous Zoom meeting and I was thinking about what my Dharma talk would be, I wouldn't really be listening to what was being shared. Or if I'm receiving text messages, so I look at my phone while I'm supposed to be on screen listening. I'm not really giving my full attention to the text message, and I'm not really giving my full attention to what's happening in this meeting. But when I hear it completely with my whole body and mind, then that changes everything, as I realize that then I'm fully present and I don't have this nagging idea that I should be doing something else. And then when I move on to the next activity, I don't have that nagging feeling either, because I'm fully concentrating on this one. Or I don't have to apologize and say, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't really get what you said. Or I don't have to, you know, send a message full of spelling errors or an incomplete message that wasn't really what, didn't fully convey what I wanted to say. We can also see the ramifications of this in the greater world, of what is happening in our world. You know, if we really followed Suzuki's instruction of forgetting dualistic ideas, life would be poetry. Or I read today that there was an Iranian filmmaker who was stabbed to death with his wife in Tehran. It's not really clear to me what happened. I don't think anyone really knows who did it or whatever, but I was reading about him because I was not familiar really with him. And he said, cinema is like poetry, which is, I had never thought of this before, but he said, cinema is like poetry. It can't take sides with anyone. And Suzuki is saying the same thing. So we don't take sides. Our Dharma practice is not about taking sides, or it's about taking everyone's side. You can flip it whichever way you want. And for me, this is really familiar because poetry is about that as well. There are no sides to be taken, maybe we could say. Now this is when now we're talking about the second step where everything is one. First, we've seen the sides. They've been very clear what the different sides are, what the different squares on the screen are, what are different, all of the differences. Like Bernie Glassman said, we share all these differences. That's the main thing we share, is our differences. We share that we all have different differences, something like that. But that's where we meet, because we're all the same. We all have things we like and things we don't like. We all have ideas. We all have positions. We all have categories that we fit into or don't fit into. So first we see only these differences. Then we see that we are all one, if only because we all share the same thing, being different. Or every, like my day, the activity, each of my activities was of equal value. It doesn't mean that they all involve the same kind of, you know, one involves money and one involves attention. One involves giving a Dharma talk, one involves teaching a class. One involves talking to my son, another involves talking to my husband. They're different, but yet it's one. My presence with each is one. Then, so when we see that they're all one, we can then see, you know, sometimes we talk about a synthesis, but it's not actually a synthesis. It's that then we can see that all is one and all is different. Which then changes everything. Then we can understand truly whatever it is, because we've seen the differences and the oneness. I read this story today from Bernie Glassman's wife, or his widow, whose blog I read, and she is of Jewish heritage. Her parents escaped the Holocaust and settled in Israel, and then immigrated to the United States, and then moved back to Israel. And her sister and brother live in Israel, and they have children. And Eve lives in the U.S. And she said she talked with her nephew, who is mid-30s probably, and had recently done his military reserve requirement, something, you know, 6 months ago or something. And because he speaks Arabic, he was sent to somewhere in the West Bank, and so that he could communicate with the population. And some event happened, I don't know what it was, and the army herded up all the a bunch of young men who had been near the event, whatever it was, and they all had to wait to be questioned individually. And her nephew had to sit with them outside while they were waiting to be interviewed. And they were not happy, and they were grumbling. And he said to them in Arabic, he said, "Well, okay. This is not, you know, nobody's happy about this situation. How about if I sing you a song?" And so he started singing them a song in Arabic. And pretty soon somebody suggested another song and another song. And then they all started singing together songs in Arabic. And then they were telling jokes and sharing cigarettes and sharing water, and while waiting to be taken in to be questioned. And then while this was going on, one of them stopped and he said, "You know what? I hate Jews." And her nephew said, "What? What do you mean? You hate me?" And the guy said, "No, I don't hate you. I hate Jews." Her nephew was clearly a Jew. He was wearing a yarmulke, as she said. But this is an example of how, when we, you know, let go of our ideas and our positions. His "I hate Jews" was, you know, this fixed idea. But in the moment when he gave himself entirely over to singing songs and cigarettes and whatever, sharing, sharing their oneness in that moment, sharing their discomfort. Nobody wanted to be there. The soldier didn't want to be there, and those guys didn't want to be there. I changed everything. And he could even say, no, I don't hate you. I hate Jews. So it's his idea is hate, but his experience is not. And this is a, you know, this is a great teaching to hear stories like that. And I think we all can relate to that. You know, the stereotype is, you know, people say, oh, I don't hate Black people. Some of my best friends are Black. Or, you know, this is a terrible thing that people say. Or, yeah, I don't hate Jews. My son-in-law is a Jew or something. But there is some truth to that, that when we intimately know someone, something, ourselves, then all of those opinions and ideas are meaningless. They no longer apply. And then we can, as Suzuki says, you know, everything can become your teacher and everything can become the object of appreciation. Then we can look at the other people we meet differently and the other situations in our life differently. You know, if I approached my activities today of, oh, we don't have any more butter. Somebody used the last butter and didn't buy it. And there's all these people in the house and they're not, you know. No, it was just okay. Well, we need butter. It was a great opportunity for me to go out and take a walk between my Zoom sessions. And I fully enjoyed it. And my two kids actually came with me, which was a bonus. So we all went out for a walk between one Zoom session and before I came here online. That what could be a chore and could lead to numerous conflicts, who's the one who used up the butter? I mean, I don't even eat butter, frankly. I'm the only one in the house who doesn't eat the butter. But so if I got stuck on that, it would have changed everything. And there would have been a conflict and accusing and blaming, and I would have been stuck in the house arguing about something. Instead, I got to go out for a walk with my two kids. And it was great because I let go of my ideas. I didn't even really have to let go of them because I've trained so much in this that it's much more easy for me to just shift into it. It's not, this is not to say that I always do it. Don't get me wrong. But tonight, I didn't really have to think of it. Maybe the desire to go for a walk was stronger than the desire to accuse someone of not replacing the butter. I don't know. So maybe it was selfish. I don't know. It doesn't matter because it ended up avoiding, or there was not even a question of conflict. So, you know, when we're thinking of, you know, the whole idea of the Holy Land, you know, as the great American, Native American Chief Black Elk said, you know, the Holy Land is everywhere. All the land is holy. And it doesn't mean that we have a pref, you know, sometimes we like a piece of land better than another, but it's all holy. And some of the, you know, some of the things we do to each other, a lot of what we do to each other and to ourselves, when we miss this, forgetting our dualistic ideas, you know, just, you know. So that's what comes up for me today in the sharing of the Dharma. sharing of life. Anyone like to add, comment, question?
When you said, hello everyone, when you said everything holy, spontaneously, nothing sacred came up.
Yeah,
Goes
absolutely.
together.
And so, like, does that have resonance for you or something? Is that why that came up? Or
Yeah. Yeah, it has resonance. It's every well, it goes in the same it's the same, it's what you were saying. If everything is sacred and everything is holy and nothing is sacred, it, everything has the same value. It's just, be it sacred, not sacred, it's just, it's the same, all of it. And has to be cherished for what it is, but it's so hard to so hard to see at times, or most of the time.
Freddie, you had your hand up?
I did. I remembered today. I don't always.
Okay.
Oh, so is it me? Yeah, I did raise my hand.
Go ahead.
Good. So I was thinking about today, earlier on today, I was thinking about Harari, the historian, the public intellectual and historian who wrote Sapiens and other works that have become very famous recently. Who was talking some time ago how we had to take a strong hand regarding Putin and the invasion of Ukraine, because if we didn't, what Putin was actually signaling to the outer world is that we would be back at the point where states just invade one another, you know, and that's the certain respect for sovereignty, for a state independence that we had for a while would go astray again, you know. And almost, you know, when I saw sort of the attack that Hamas has put on, you know, I thought that his words have become prophetic of that indeed, you know, the invasion of Ukraine signal this new territory where we are, where we just sort of, you know, the respect for states are is gone again for the sake of conquest, power, whatever we call it. But more important is that I was listening to him talking about the direct experience with his family. And some of them who lived in the territories that Hamas sort of attacked. And the way he was describing, like an old uncle and aunt of his who managed to survive the attack because they hid somewhere in the house. And how he was describing what happened over there in terms of, you know, people from Hamas going inside houses and killing parents in front of their children and decapitating people and so on and so forth. And of course, we know that these things happen in more situations. It's not new. But then when you see people describing them again, I was really struggling to sort of imagine my oneness with somebody that goes inside somebody's house and kills a parent in front of their children or decapitates them or so on and so forth. So I suppose that theoretically, I can think, yes, we're all one, so that there is oneness. Why can't we just see the oneness? Why can't we see the oneness, you know, and the frustration of that? But if I imagine myself in relation to somebody, whatever their history, processes, etc., that goes inside somebody's house and sort of kills a parent in front of their children, I can't, I have to keep that oneness away. I have to extricate myself from that oneness because I can't phantom that I sort of have the same quality that that person has, the same qualities. So I had to make myself a different kind of human from them. And I suppose that took me back to the Thich Nhat Hanh poem, Call Me By Your True Names, and all kinds of ways. But I don't know. I want to hear what you think about it. How do we keep the oneness with somebody that does something so horrible?
Well, you know, there's different ways of approaching it, and from the work that I did with Bernie Glassman, where we plunged into situations, we plunged into Jerusalem, but granted it was before this happened, so it was 20 years ago, but or plunged into Auschwitz, or plunged into Rwanda or Bosnia, all these places where horrible things happened, or some of the Indian lands in America, the streets, homeless people. We, you know, we put us, we tried to forget our ideas about good and bad and whatever, me and the other. And can we see that, okay, someone who would commit to do this, right? It was very powerful around 9/11 when we happened to be on a peacemaker retreat, actually, when 9/11 happened. Very powerful. What came up was that in order to commit an act like that, there has to be some really deep suffering going on in oneself. Otherwise, you would not do that. And that's part of our, you know, part of the reason why you say, I couldn't do that. You know, how could that be possible? You can maybe look into, well, yes, the only way that it's possible to do such harm would be to feel such deep suffering oneself and to have such grievances, such a, you know, and in the case of the Palestinian people, you know, they're deeply suffering, and the Palestinian people are not the Hamas, you know. But the Palestinian people for seven, you know, for decades have been suffering greatly, as have the Jewish people for millennium, you know. But this, I don't want to say that all Palestinians, all Jews, whatever. It's just that any act, harmful act that we commit comes from a place of not seeing the oneness. So it comes from this deep place of suffering, feeling separate, not being seen, not seeing oneself. I'm not saying that we're aware of it when we do harmful acts, because I'm sure you can identify in your own life things that you do that are harmful. Of course, you're not killing a parent in front of his child, or, you know, bombing your neighbor's property or something, but we do harmful things. And if we can look into and see where that, what the root of that is in ourselves, then that we can also identify that that's where that's coming from. It doesn't change that it's a horrendous act, but it does give us some clarity about what's happening. Why is this happening? Not even so much why, but this is what is happening. So always the base of harm is always suffering, always. And the basic suffering from our teachings is not seeing the oneness of life. The other Pedro has his hand up.
Hi, good night. My point on this issue, I was listening Pedro, and I think we have to be very careful about the Western bias. And the question I would like to ask to Roshi, there is a difference between oppressors and oppressed people. Sometimes oppressors do the they are doing continuous violence, killings, and the thing is, it has the same level, moral judgment, the violence of the oppressors and the violence of the oppressed. In the case of the Israeli-Palestinian, for each Israeli life, there is 10, maybe 100 Palestinian lives that are finished. The question is this: is the violence of the oppressors is the morally is the same as the violence of the oppressed people to be liberated? Because this question arises every time in the lot of conflicts during history. Because if the oppressor do violence constantly, it's not terrorism. If the oppressed do violence, is terrorism. I think we have to be careful with this bias and put the same value in the, on the same moral level, the violence, because the parts are different and are in a different place. Thank you.
Well, if we see, if we follow the path of in the beginning, it's all different. So there's, you know, the oppressor's violence and the oppressed's violence, and there's Israeli death, and there's 10 Palestinian deaths. That's on the level of differences, absolutely. And then people have different ideas and opinions about, isn't Israeli death worth more or less valid than a Palestinian death and all of these things. We have all those differences. But when we can let go of the ideas and the fixed opinions, then we can see the oneness of it. And violence is never the answer. And it's all one, violence. And we are all dying. We are all Israeli, we are all Palestinian. You know, if we look at this screen, every one of us is from, you know, some descended from some lineage that has wreaked violence on someone else, you know, if it's only our own family or our people, one way or the other, you know. We could say women are more oppressed than men. You know, there's all kinds of ways we can look at it. But ultimately, we're all one. And violence is never the answer. Violence will only beget more violence. And what's ironic is that, you know, the basic teachings of this region that are, that is full of such strife, all of the major religions that were born in that region preach peace. And not not hurting one another, and they're all brothers. You know, if you can't really tell the difference between who's who, except the way they dress, and then their economic status, and then their address.
Can I quickly say, just in response to Pedro, that I would feel exactly the same if the story had been told the other way around, if it was Israeli soldiers invading the house of Palestinian families and doing the same kind of violent act. So I'm not into dividing the quality of violence. My problem is the identification of oneness when somebody does that violence. But I just wanted to clarify that. I would have felt the same if the story was told the other way around.
Freddie, I think you had your hand up at one point.
Every summer, I have my nephew that comes to visit me with his mom. He's a young lad. Maybe he's 13 today. But I have a very distinct, very clear memory of one day I took him to Toys R Us. I thought it would be a great idea because I could buy him a toy, a beautiful toy, because in Toys R Us, to me, it's a paradise. For our children, that they have everything. So I thought, I want to please him. Let's take him to Toys R Us, and maybe we can even buy toys for his cousin. So we went over there, And I was not prepared to what I saw. It was all over. Everyone's in Toys R Us playing with one toy and then with another one, and then even arguing with other children for that toy. I said, no, Toys R Us are hell for children. I will never, never bring my nephew there again. I was just amazed. I said, no, Toys R Us is hell. It's not paradise for children. When we see children, it's easy to have a perspective. But when it's adult, we identify directly. But when it's children, it's easy. The stands of children of a toy everywhere. Just no. We have and that's how I discover what I call the Toys R Us complex.
I just wanted to say that I was struck by the story of the cousin of Eve who started to sing. So I'm wondering, really wondering, where did that come from? The impulse to start singing. It's really impressive.
Well, you know, I agree, huh? It is. It's quite stunning. And clearly he was not attached to his identity of Jew, soldier, good singer, bad singer. Maybe he's a good singer, I don't know, but Hebrew speaker. Clearly he was able to let go of all of that and open his heart to just this moment or something.
Yeah, I think anyone else would be annoyed by the situation and maybe scared or unsure of himself. I would be, I'm sure. What would I do? And it's already too late. He just starts singing. It's, wow.
Yeah, thank you for this. I can't pretend it's not on my mind what's going on. And I have the same feeling because I've observed it in different situations. Anyone that is capable of going far in violent acts has, I even think this about Putin now, has been a victim of violent acts. It's like the pedophilia. The barrier was not fixed at some important part and moment in the person's life, and they don't really know what they're doing, in my opinion. And the other thing that was, while we're talking about this, the other night I decided to go see Al Jazeera to hear another way of looking at this, because as I say, I lived in the region, and so easy to get into vocabulary that leads your mind into a brick wall. And it was the same vocabulary, only it was directed in the opposite direction. And then that reminded me of all this argumentation in France about you either say terrorist or war crime, and it makes a really big difference. And I'm not mocking them. I understand, I think, why makes such a big difference. But how does it happen? So, yeah, why does it happen that there's such a strong demonization of the the opposite side. I mean, look at Putin telling everybody that the Ukrainians were Nazis. It didn't have anything to do with anything, but find the one word that will make it justifiable for you to be able to rape their wives and kill the babies. It's how does that happen?
Well, you know, that's what we've been saying, that if we each look at ourselves and we see when we, you know, if I bring it back to my story of not having butter, you know, if I go into if I plunge into blaming, separation, me, the other, accusing, making it a chore, and granted, you know, not having butter is not the same thing as not having electricity and water and or having your home overrun by a bunch of gunmen, no matter which side they're on, you know. But it comes down to the same thing. It's this not seeing my true nature, which means not seeing the nature of all things and the oneness of life. If we see the oneness, then we don't do that. If we experience it, if we know the other is I, we don't do that. If we see, you know, like the call I was on for 2 hours before this was the Healthy Boundaries course that I teach for Buddhist leaders. And of course, a lot of the conversation was much like what we're having about the same subject. And it struck me at one point, and I told them, I said, you know, this is interesting because can we see that boundaries are not something that keep us apart, but that keep us safe, you know, or give us some way to relate to one another so that we don't harm one another? That's why we talk about boundaries in the context of power and relationships, and abuse of power and abuse of relationships and everything. We have boundaries so that everyone's clear on what their role is. And we have, you know, the boundaries of our home, so we're clear on this is our space in which to live safely. And we recognize that our neighbor needs the same thing. We don't need to have to go across their boundaries. We don't need the boundary to keep them out. It's more to just keep us all safe. But first we have to see the oneness. First we have to see that we're all one, and that we only, these boundaries are all just something that we've chosen so that we can live together peacefully, not something so that we will separate each other and then kill each other and fight about it. Someone posted something. So Pedro saying the violence of the Warsaw Jewish ghetto uprising against oppression and death is not the answer. Well, you know, we can always justify, you know, depending on what side we're on. You know, there's the justification of dropping the atomic bomb on Hiroshima, you know. The justification was that it would save a lot of lives. And I'm not taking, you know, I'm a poet and I'm a Zen teacher. I don't take sides, you know. When we get into these questions of is it justified or not, or is it, what was the word you used, Pedro? The answer, right? It is an answer. It is, obviously, it's an answer. And we're free to choose whatever answer we want, however we choose to reply. And we can best reply with the least harm from a place of seeing the wholeness of life, not knowing, so not having a fixed position, bearing witness, seeing what the situation is, and probably in the Jewish ghetto, in that desperate situation, that was the appropriate answer. I don't know. I wasn't there, but I don't know. But I do know from my experience that I can best respond to a situation when I let go of my fixed ideas and open to it, to whatever is here. And then I can better respond.
Yeah, I was just hearing you speak, and I think this is very challenging to do that in a time where like people have such fixed positions about what's happening, and we are demanded to have an opinion as well, and to pick sides, and to, you know, it's so urgent as well. It's very challenging to just open your heart and yeah, and just acknowledge you don't know, and looking into yourself as well. When there's so much discourse about so many things. But I think that's the challenge of sitting as well, was just sitting really in the midst of what's really harsh and complicated and yeah.
Yes, it is. It's radical. This is a radical practice. Well, and as Joa said, I forget it was when last week's talk or at the study group or something, Joa said that he, you know, was so much struggling that he just wanted to take his cushion and go sit at the Place de la République, which is this place in Paris where whenever there's a demonstration, whenever there's something, it happens at the Place de la République. And he was feeling like he just wanted to take his cushion and sit there in the middle. And someone else said, Lisa said, oh, if you do it, Joel, let me know. I'll come too. That would be quite a radical thing to do, you know. It doesn't mean we don't have opinions, you know. It doesn't mean, you know, I have strong opinions about subjects. It doesn't mean, but it's that they're not fixed. And I don't let that be how I live my life. Because I know that's living it from a fragmented rather than a whole life. And I know how much harm arises from that when it's fragmented.
But I have a feeling that there's no way for me to know what would happen to me if I were huddled in a room with somebody slaughtering people around me.
Right.
I can't, maybe I just don't want to imagine it, but I don't think I can imagine either. And I don't think I'd be this person that's sitting here right now.
Yeah, I don't think we do know. We really don't. But we can know in our lives, in our situations, and where we are now. And we can all, even saying that, we understand the horror of it. And we understand, you know, like Pedro was saying, Pedro Oliveira, that it's just so out of what I could imagine possibly happening for myself. And yet, I can tell you, sitting at Auschwitz for 5 days, I could see that I also do that. I can be an executioner. Not that I would put people in a concentration camp, but as one woman at Auschwitz said, you know, I realize I've run a concentration camp in my mind all my life, picking and choosing what I like and what I don't like in my head, and repressing and killing everything I don't like. And she was desperate, saying, and I've done that to my children too. I did that in my family. So we can see this in our lives, even if we have no idea what it's like to be there.
And we do it on an everyday life basis. We do it. I've just read a book not so long ago, a very short book called Climate Change is Racist. The title is very suggestive. But it all speaks about how in the North Hemisphere, with our lifestyle, my lifestyle as well, you know, of driving cars and doing this and all our consumption, we're killing the people in the South Hemisphere. We kill them every day with our excess carbon consumption. So we're all executioners.
Exactly. Yep. That's right. And we are all victims. And we can all be agents of wholeness and love and change and beauty. It's not only, so this applies to not only the bad stuff, but it also applies to the beauty of the world.
My issue is with the position of not knowing and practice going into a position of not knowing. Because I feel that if I go there too much, I don't act.
Well, and this is an idea you are holding on to, and I absolutely understand that.
Possibly, I can't see it different at this point. I'm not close to the fact that maybe I will, but this is where it's possible for me to be at this point. If I'm constantly not knowing, why should I act?
And this is very common that we think that. If we don't know, we won't act. We always think that, yeah. And so I encourage you to stay with that, to keep, well, as you know, I always say this to you, just keep looking at that. Yeah, stay with it. You know, usually when we are pushed in, you know, extreme situations, then we really don't know anymore. That's why, you know, in moments of car accidents or great loss or you know, great overwhelming beauty or falling in love or something, you know, falling in love is like this massive not knowing. You know, we forget everything we knew about whatever, and we give ourselves totally to this moment. It's beautiful. It's beautiful. It's you know, moments when the rug is pulled out from under us is when that not knowing suddenly becomes clear. Well, I thank you all for engaging in this conversation. It's rich. It's really wonderful to hear everyone give. I like giving everyone the opportunity to say, share something if they want to. And so I try to open these talks up these days. So thank you very much. Next Monday, I will not be here because I will be on retreat. But there will be sitting, and I think Joa probably will be here. I'm not sure, but there will definitely be. If neither Joa or I are here, please do a circle together. That would be a really nice thing to do. So, thank you. Have a good evening.